So, I have to say it. Greetings, verbivores. How are you this evening? I see faces out there, familiar faces that I know from other contexts. And so you know who I am as Christy Smith, but there may be those among you who know my voice only and not my visage. So I'd like to introduce myself. My name is Christy Smith. I am a native of Poplar, Montana. I went to school at MSU for a BS in anthropology, archaeology, and that's kind of where Christy the Word Smith starts. I am host and writer for the Christy the Word Smith radio series, which, if you haven't heard of it before, is a 2-minute radio series daily on Yellowstone Public Radio, 8:30 in the morning. 105.1 is the frequency. Also, the word Smith can be heard at 91.9 on KGLT, which is the producing radio station on the campus of Montana State University. I started the series in 1990, and so it's in its 27th year of production. The series lasts only 2 minutes, so it goes by pretty fast. And every day is a new story about the origins of a word or an expression or a series of words from our marvelous American English tongue. And I started it as I was a student at MSU, taking my anthropology classes. One of the subtexts of anthropology is linguistics. When I started the linguistics studies, I became so fascinated by what linguistics is. It is how human beings produce words, what we do with our words, why there are so many, many languages around the world, etc., etc. And it really is, the well is deep in linguistics. And I just thoroughly fell in head first. And the more I learned about linguistics, the more I thought, you know, everybody ought to know this stuff. It's just absolutely fascinating. And so I dreamed up a bully pulpit where I could take what I learned in linguistics and broadcast it so that other people could learn it. I thought I would like to create a radio series about dictionaries, words, linguistic principles, and KGLT was handy. KGLT is a student-run radio station on the campus of Montana State University. So anybody who's a student at MSU can take advantage of their facilities. So I thought that I would, and I dreamed up what I wanted to do with this radio series. I wanted to call it Christy the Word Smith, after my name, Christy Smith, which I thought was so absolutely bloody clever. Thought this was meant to be. And I went up one May day to KGLT general offices. The general manager at the time was Phil Charles. I told him about this plan that I had to create a radio series around dictionaries and the words and phrases in the English language and linguistics. And he sat there for a minute and looked at me and he went, "Sure, why not?" And so it was that stroke of fortune that led me into a career in radio as opposed to a career in anthropology or archaeology, which was my goal in going to MSU. So I completed my anthropology studies 7 years after I started, and I had to make a decision whether to go on with anthropology or with radio, and I chose radio, and I'm so glad I did. It's just been such a delightful career. I'm not a linguist, and I am not a dictionary compiler, but I do love dictionaries, and I love the language. And in my 27 years of writing about the language, reading dictionaries, talking about our marvelous American English tongue, I have noticed a couple things about our language. One completely notable thing is that the English language is young, as we speak it in America. It is ebullient. It is forward-looking. We, as American English speakers, love to make up new words. We love to embrace terminologies from all around the world, from all different languages. And we bring new words on every year. every year there's a new term that fits into either a paper dictionary or a digital dictionary. We mash words together to create new words. And I want you to take a look at some of these terms right here as a case in point. All of these terms are 60 years old or less. The dates that you see after each term indicate the year in which each word appeared in print according to the Oxford English Dictionary. So most of us sitting here cannot imagine an American English word without these terms because they are so useful, they describe the world that we live in. All of us have used almost all of these terms. Here's another remarkable roster. These are 30 years old or younger. You see some kind of sassy terms there, like staycation, fashionista, locavore. And probably my favorite item on this roster is the prefix wiki, W-I-K-I, with a dash afterwards indicates that it's a prefix. We see this prefix in things like WikiLeaks and Wiktionary and Wikipedia. It turns out that wiki is a Hawaiian word, and it means quick in Hawaiian. Wiki wiki means quick, quick, hurry up. And so Wikipedia, for example, is a rapid way to look up information. Wiktionary is a quick dictionary. So we see that, and there are many hundreds of terms that we could talk about in this kind of forward-looking, ebullient sort of aspect of the American English language. But at the same time, the English language is very, very conservative, and we keep words around for centuries that serve us well, that are very utilitarian, and we have thousands of those kinds of words, too, that have been in the corpus of the American English language or the English language for thousands of years, and that's what we're going to talk about tonight. We'll leave this topic behind. This is just kind of a way to compare new words with old. We have many, many words that we still use that were inspired by stories and mythologies that we no longer believe in, but we still retain the words that represent them. That's what we're going to talk about tonight. And that's why this topic is called Nike's Echo. Both Nike and both Echo are going to feature in this a list of stories that I'm about to tell you in the next few minutes. And I contend that the Greek gods are still with us because we evoke their names almost every day, as you'll see. Now, when I was young, I loved to read the Greek myths. How many out there are mythophiles who have read a lot about the myths as a younger person? You'll recognize some of the characters, some of the gods, the monsters, the wood nymphs, the sea nymphs, the goddesses, as we go on. Those of you who are unfamiliar with the Greek mythological characters, I hope we'll find these stories compelling and astounding like I did to know that these particular characters inspired words that we still use today. So I'm going to start at the beginning with the Greek Titans. The Titans were a race of enormous, elemental, powerful, warlike beings that were children of the world's first couple, Gaia, who was the earth goddess, and Uranus, who was the sky father, and between those two, they engendered dozens and dozens of giants called the Titans. They lived in the universe before humans were created, according to Greek mythology, and it seems as though their primary focus in existence was to wage war. They were constantly fighting each other. As their tribe increased, they broke off into factions. Their battles are numerous. You can read about them ad nauseum. It's said that when the Titans went to war, the foundations of the universe trembled. They were so enormous and so warlike. So, down below on the boulders, we see a representation of what one artist thinks the Titans look like. So they're down below, they're hoisting boulders, they have spears, and they're about ready to do battle with another group up on the top, right up there. These are the gods of Mount Olympus that you might be familiar with. There's Zeus right here with his lightning bolts. There's Cronos, the father of time. There is, someone has a trident up there. So the Titans and the Greek gods, of course, were warring with each other as well. And here you see a battle that's about to happen between those two factions. The Titans no longer exist, except only in our imaginations and in the stories, but they've left a linguistic footprint for us. Oh, there's another depiction of the chaos that ensues when the Titans do battle. Titanium is the name of a lightweight metal alloy that was identified in 1796, described at that time. And then we have the name of the passenger ship that was mighty and powerful, but like the Greek Titans, was tragically flawed. We all know what happened. We all know what happened to the Titanic in 1912. Now we're going to go to focus in on one particular Titan, and his name is Atlas. Atlas happened to be the cousin of the king of the gods, Zeus, and they were mortal enemies. One day, in an epic battle to achieve control over the universe, Zeus and Atlas went at it. And Atlas was conquered, and Zeus was the victor. And Zeus sentenced him to a very bizarre punishment. Atlas was to forever hold the sky and the earth apart. So he, in Greek mythology, is responsible for keeping the sky from collapsing into the earth. We often see this kind of image in popular advertising, for example. We see an enormous, muscular man straining under the weight of a globe of some sort. It's not the globe. It represents the vault of the heavens. And if you were to look at this marble statue and go up closely, you would see that that orb has the signs or the representations of the constellations on them. There's Aries, the ram, and Taurus, the bull, and the scorpion, and so forth. So it represents poor, unfortunate Atlas, whose job it was to hold the earth and the sky apart. And the Greeks believe that he stood there for so long, for eternities, that his body literally turned to stone. He was petrified. Here is a representation, an older map of the African continent. It says Africa today. It was probably like Africa 70 years ago. But right up here on the northwest shoulder of the African continent, you'll see the Atlas Mountains. The Greeks believed that this literally was the petrified body of Atlas as he stood there for eternity, holding the sky and the earth apart. Then, of course, to the west of the African continent is the Atlantic Ocean that was also named after the unfortunate Titan. Here's something that looks like it has nothing in common with what is being discussed right now, but it does. It is the first cervical vertebrae of the human skeleton. This is the vertebrae that sits directly beneath the skull, and it's uniquely designed so that the pads, right here, is where the skull sits. And in popular parlance, this vertebrae is known as the atlas because it holds the weight of our skulls, just like the Titan Atlas held the weight of the heavens on his shoulders. So here he is in his chronology. Atlantic Ocean, 1601. Probably Shakespeare knew about the name of this newly named ocean, the Atlantic, named after Atlas. Collection of maps is called an atlas, starting in 1636. And the vertebrae that I just showed you came on board linguistically in 1699. Now we're going to go from, we're going to concentrate less on the dudes and go to the female figures who are represented in Greek mythology. These are the nine Greek muses. The muses, thank Zeus, did not wage war. Instead, they were responsible for The branches of higher learning, such as mathematics and astronomy and poetry and theater, and there's a muse for pantomime of all things, history and so forth. The muses were the nine daughters of a titan named Mnemosyne, who was the titan of memory, the titaness of memory. She was responsible for memory in the human race. It's said that she gave birth to all nine of the muses at once. Can you imagine? But each of the muses played a specific instrument. So all the muses were genius music makers. They had beautiful singing voices. Because they were all sisters, they learned probably to sing in nine-part harmony, I imagine. And it's this image here shows them dancing around their patron goddess, Athena, who is right in the middle there. It's said that the gods of Mount Olympus would invite the muses to come and sing and dance, and the muses were very popular because they knew how to flatter the gods with telling deeds or singing songs of their exploits and their deeds. And for my money, the muses are responsible for one of the English language's most important terms. This word literally means the art and technology of the muses, which is the singing of songs and the playing of instruments. You can see how early that word came into the English language. And of course, this word is also shared amongst dozens of other languages on the earth. Museum refers to the seat or the shrine of the muses. The first museums were open-air edifices where people would go and pay tribute to the muses, also to call on them for inspiration. Today, poets and musicians sort of wryly say that they're calling on their muses for inspiration in verse and for artistic inspiration. So, throughout history, people would go to the shrine of the muses to be inspired. In the 1600s, these open-air edifices became enclosed buildings where people would keep precious artifacts, works of art, fossils like the Museum of the Rockies, etc. And so I contend that the muses are still with us because whenever we go into a museum or a shrine to the muses, there they are as they inspire us with these beautiful things that we see inside the walls. This is a depiction of not a god, not a titan, but of a young mortal man by the name of Narcissus. Narcissus, it is said in Greek mythology, was one of the most beautiful beings that was ever born. In form, in symmetry, in coloration, he was absolutely gorgeous. And whoever saw this young man fell in love with him. That included the gods, the goddesses, mortal women, wood nymphs, sea nymphs, everybody who beheld Narcissus wanted his attention because he was so beautiful, made overtures to him, begged for his love. But Narcissus, for his part, was only a boy, and he had no use for love, at least not yet. One of his favorite pastimes was to go hunting in the woods with his companions. One day he was out hunting, and he was separated from his companions, but he wasn't worried, he wasn't lost, he knew right where he was, but he got thirsty, and he stopped beside a still pool to take a drink. His bow and arrow are right there. He is ready to quench his thirst. He gets on his belly, he looks down into the water, and in the water is the most beautiful creature he has ever seen. He stares at the creature. The creature stares back. Narcissus smiles at the creature. The creature smiles back. Pretty soon, Narcissus says a few words to this creature, and the creature's lips move as if he's trying to talk back. They stare at each other for long, long moments. Narcissus reaches down to touch the creature, and the creature dissolves. And Narcissus, in panic, draws back, and soon the creature reappears. And of course, there is no creature in the pool, but it is Narcissus' own image. He's seeing himself for the first time, and he is beholding his own beauty. You can see him transfixed by his beauty there in the still pool. Narcissus stays there for so long, he forgets to eat. He doesn't drink because every time he touches the water, the creature disappears. Finally, he stays so long that he perishes. He dies of hunger. This is very sad to the gods who witness this whole affair, and they become remorseful that such a creature dies, and so they make him immortal by turning him into a flower, the Narcissus. And these have just finished their blooms here in North America, but here Narcissus lives with us. He's reborn every spring in all of his symmetrical beauty. So we see the name of the flower coming on board in 1150. And then here's something else. Narcissism is the condition whereby a person is preoccupied with his or her own beauty and well-being. And this was a condition that was described in 1822 by a German physician. We're going to pull the camera back a little bit and see that Narcissus wasn't alone when he falls in love with himself. There is a young wood nymph who is witnessing this tragedy, and she's looking at him very, very wistfully because she knows what's going to happen. This young wood nymph was named Echo, and like everybody else, Echo fell in love with Narcissus. She followed him everywhere he went. Though she was beautiful and lovely to look at, Narcissus paid no attention to her because he thought that she was insane. And he thought that she was insane because Echo was unable to speak. That is, she wasn't able to produce her own original sentences. She was, however, able to repeat the words of others if they spoke directly to her. And what happened to Echo was that she was once a very gay and chatty and very sociable wood nymph. She talked all the time. She was happy and bright and sunny. And she offended the queen of the gods, Hera, who could not stand her empty chatter. And so one day, Hera smote her with a terrible curse that her voice would be silenced except to repeat the words of others. So Echo, who was simply not on Narcissus' radar at all, would gladly have told Narcissus what was about to happen to him, but she couldn't because she could not utter any of her own sentences. So she watched him perish, and all that was left after he died, after she withdrew to the lonely parts of the world, was her voice. And here we have the echo that means reflected sound coming on board in 1340. And the Greeks believed that when you were out in the mountains, in the wilderness, and you threw your voice against a hard surface, the voice that came back to you, they thought, was literally echo repeating your words. Here we have a very familiar image. This is called, popularly, the Winged Victory of Samothrace, and she stands in the Louvre Museum in Paris. She's otherwise known as Nike, the goddess of victory, a gorgeous marble statue who, over the centuries, has lost her head and her arms, but she is still, nevertheless, strikingly beautiful. The Greeks called on Nike for victory in battle. When the war was waging, they would pray to her to come to their aid to help them win whatever battle they were in. It's thought that this marble statue was affixed to the prow of a Greek naval ship at one time in homage to the goddess of victory, Nike. Now we go from the divine to the athletic. Of course, this is a very early version of the Nike athletic shoe. The story behind this is that in 1969, an entrepreneur by the name of Phil Knight founded an athletic shoe company. And of course, he had to name it, and so he and his peers talked about names for a while, and they came up with this beautiful name, Nike. And of course, it is most appropriate if you are in any kind of athletic competition. Who better to be associated with than the goddess of victory herself? So the Nike shoe was so named in 1971, and the famous Nike swoosh came on board in the same year. And of course, Nike is still with us because millions of people call on her name all around the world every day. The goddess of victory is still here with us, at least linguistically. Here's another one of the female characters in Greek mythology. This is a very dramatic scene. We see a woman bending over by the shores of a river. She is holding an infant by his foot, and she's dipping him into the waters. This is an image of a sea nymph by the name of Thetis, T-H-E-T-I-S. She's just given birth to a baby boy, and a seer comes along and tells her that her baby boy is going to be a famous, invincible warrior. And she is flattered indeed, and to think that she, Thetis, a sea nymph, is going to give birth to an invincible warrior like the gods. She thinks about this for a little while, and she wants to make sure that this prediction comes true. She wants her son to live forever, to be a warrior, to be renowned throughout the world. And so she takes him to the waters of the magical river Styx, which separates the land of the living from the land of the dead. In the background here, you see souls departing from the land of the living here across the river Styx to the land of the dead. You see bats up here. She's hired a torchbearer to help her see through the Stygian gloom. Her young son she has named Achilles. She takes Achilles to this stream that flows through the underworld. She knows that if she were to dip him in the water and fully submerge him, that he would become immortal like the gods. She's a sea nymph, so she knows these secrets. So this is what she's doing at this moment. He's halfway submerged, but in the moments to come, she plunges him all the way into the cold water and withdraws him. And she thinks, aha, I've done it. He is immortal. He'll live forever, my son. However, she makes a mistake. And those of you who have read this story know what it is. She has gripped his heel so tightly that the water is unable to penetrate the skin in that area. So technically, he has never been immersed in the waters of the river Styx. She doesn't know that, though. And so she brings her son up to believe that he is invincible. He'll live forever. He grows up to be a confident warrior. He is called to fight in the Battle of Troy. And everyone throughout the Greek world is frightened of him because they think he is indeed invincible, but he looks like a human being. Everyone thinks he cannot be killed in battle. However, Achilles has a mortal enemy by the name of Paris, and Paris wants nothing more than to see his arch rival dead. So Paris has a patron god by the name of Adonis, and Adonis knows the secret. He knows that if Achilles is shot with an arrow through that vulnerable heel of his, that he will indeed die. So, here we are. Adonis, right here, Paris, right there. Adonis is pointing to Achilles, this figure right here, and saying, that's where the arrow goes. Shoot it through his heel. And so right down here, you see the eel. The arrow piercing his heel. He is dying, and we see this is a very dramatic scene. The putti up there are going, oh! So it's a breathless moment when Achilles finally dies, and nobody thought that it could happen, but Paris did it. So this interesting story has given us the phrase Achilles tendon, which refers to the tendon that runs from the heel all the way back up to the calf. And then Achilles heel itself, which is a phrase that we refer to somebody's personal weakness. Everyone has an Achilles heel that makes them vulnerable. One of my Achilles heels is that I am terrified of lightning and thunder. So I appear confident in many, many situations, but let a cloud start to boil up in the west that looks like it's going to be a storm cloud, and I start to sweat, I want to get in the house, and I am no longer the confident Christy the wordsmith that I usually am. So if you really examine yourself, you will find that you also have an Achilles heel that renders you mortal, or seemingly more so. Here we have the depiction of another Greek hero. This is Odysseus, who was a human being, but he was a brilliant statesman. He was king of Ithaca, his Greek island home. He was a warrior of great renown. He was a family man. He had a beautiful wife named Penelope, a young son. He was a happy man until he was called to fight in the Battle of Troy. So he gathered half a dozen or a dozen of his best naval ships, his finest fighting men, and he took off from his island of Ithaca to Troy to fight the battle. He did, and he was successful. He won many wars, and his renown increased until 10 years later. The Battle of Troy came to an end, and it was time for Odysseus to go home. And he was very happy. He missed his wife, he missed his son, he missed his homeland, and so he took what battleships were left to him and his men that had not perished, and he went back across the Mediterranean Sea to his home. What should have taken a matter of days or a week or maybe 2 weeks to get home took Odysseus and his men 10 years to travel. And that's because the gods kept throwing him off course. Many tragedies befell Odysseus and his men. He was almost eaten by the Cyclops. He was captured by wrong women on certain Greek islands. His men were almost devoured by a six-headed monster and a whirlpool, blah, blah, blah. It goes on and on and on. Finally, Odysseus was nearing his home. The gods promised him they could go home, and he had one more trial to face, and that was to go through the island of the Sirens. And the Sirens were these horrible half-bird, half-women creatures that inhabited a very rocky island. They were cannibalistic, and so they dined on the flesh of sailors that shipwrecked on their rocky shores. Now, any self-respecting sailor would not come near the shores of a rocky island, but the Sirens had it figured out. They had beautiful, beautiful, bewitching singing voices, and when they saw ships coming from afar, they would fly up into the sky and start to sing, and the sailors would hear this song first very, very faintly in the distance, and as they came closer and closer, the song bewitched them, and so they would all turn their ships toward this island until their ships came to the rocks, were dashed to pieces, they fell into the water, and then the Sirens would fly in and devour their flesh. Terrible story. Odysseus had to do this as his one last trial. And so Odysseus was prepared. He had his men stop their ears up with beeswax. He himself was ordered tied to the mast so he wouldn't jump overboard to join the beautiful songs that he was hearing. So we see this moment where the ship is going through. You can see the steep rocks. You can see Odysseus tied to the mast, and then these creatures up here singing for all their worth to make the sailors go off course. You see this creature right here. She is landed on the bow of the ship. She is peering into the face of the sailor, singing and singing and singing. They can't, the sailors cannot hear them, however, and they finally make it through safely. It's said that the sirens were so frustrated that they were not able to draw these men into the water that they threw themselves into the waves and drowned. Ha ha. Odysseus wins. But the sirens, of course, have left their linguistic footprint with us, or their wing prints. The word siren was used metaphorically to refer to a beautiful woman who seduces someone for something that she needs. Shakespeare used it this way. And then the device that is we associate with danger and warning, the siren. This is an old-fashioned exploded view, of course, of a siren. Aptly named because sirens are associated with danger, just like the sirens of the ancient world. And here's their chronology. The siren that means enchantress was used by Shakespeare for the first time in one of his plays in 1594. And then the siren that means warning device was invented and named in 1879. Switching gears now to the half-goat, half-human satyr by the name of Pan. Pan was born to a wood nymph, and his appearance as a newborn repulsed his mother so badly that she abandoned him in the woods and ran away. So Pan was an orphan, and as he lay in the woods, he was a lusty creature, and he cried and cried because he was getting hungry. And there were some nearby wood nymphs that had no idea that he had just been born and that his mother had abandoned him. So they came to his rescue, and they fed him, and they rescued him. And Pan, the half-goat, half-man satyr, was so grateful to the wood nymphs that he dedicated himself to their welfare for the rest of his life. In fact, he became a sylvan god, a god of the woods. He was the protector of the shepherds of the hills of ancient Greece. And the shepherds often called on him for assistance when they were in trouble, and Pan often helped. However, Pan was a very unpredictable and irascible god. The more I read about him, the more I think he's like the coyote trickster of North American tales, because oftentimes he did more harm than good. One of his favorite tricks to pull was in the middle of the night to stand on top of a hill and throw boulders down into the valley below, which would frighten the flocks and the herds and wake the shepherds up, and everybody would scatter in terror. Sometimes Pan would rip the branches off of trees and do the same thing and scream so loudly that everyone in the district ran. They were just terrified of this anger, of this trickster kind of character of Pan. And so, because Pan was so unpredictable and he inspired this fear in people, we get the word panic, meaning the fear inspired by the god Pan. And all of us have felt that panic before. It's a stricturing in our throat. Maybe our hair stands on end. And the Greeks attributed that fear, literally, to the god Pan. Here is an image of a minor goddess in the Greek pantheon by the name of Iris. Iris had a small but important mission. She was the messenger goddess to the queen of the goddesses, Hera. Whenever Hera wanted to impart a message to her husband, Zeus, she would call upon Iris, who would then take a message from Hera to Zeus. Iris had the power of flight, but she was not bestowed with wings, so she was quite magical. In some traditions, She was clad in beautiful, multicolored robes. Not in this tradition, however. She doesn't have much on. But you can see that she is flying through the air without the aid of wings. And it's thought that when she flew across the sky in her arcing flight, that her multicolor robes would leave color hanging in the atmosphere for a while. And so the Greeks believed that Iris was responsible for the rainbow. And we can see just a trace of the rainbow right there. So Ovid, who was a Roman poet who lived in around 40 BC, he was responsible for many poetic interpretations of classical myths. And this is what he writes about Iris. He says, "Iris, in her thousand hues enrobed, traced through the sky her archery bow. Iris entered the chambers of Hera, and the bright, sudden radiance of her robe lit up the hallowed place. Iris departed and fled away back over the arching rainbow as she came." So Iris, the minor goddess, is responsible for the name of the beautiful flower that they've just finished blooming here in Montana. And indeed, irises have been engineered to represent all the colors of the rainbow. That's why they're so named. We see irises in white and this lavender color, black, brown, et cetera, et cetera. It was hoped that they would represent all the colors of the rainbow. The colored portion of the eye in mammals and fish is called the iris because, of course, they come in all different colors too, from the brightest yellow or white to almost black. So iris, the eye color, was first seen in print in 1525. The flower was so named in 1562. And then the lovely adjective iridescent, which means shining in all colors of the rainbow, 1794. It was difficult to stop right there, because there are so many other stories that can be told about words engendered by mythological characters and situations. Some of the other ones that I did not mention were the term aphrodisiac, which comes from the name Aphrodite, the goddess of love. The verb to tantalize also comes from Greek mythology. Morphine, the word, comes from a character in Greek mythology. So does cereal, the name of grains or breakfast food. And the word chaos, and it goes on and on. So this could have been a lot longer, but I stopped it there.